Okay, thank you. Because we're quite a small firm, I quite like these ones where I can be quite clever about the presentation. So essentially I'm going to be talking about presentations I've been giving. I recommend this if you're doing it, because it kind of takes the pressure off the question side of it, because essentially my answer will always be, oh, well, actually, I was saying that for this audience, you know, not relevant in this context. So let me describe, I've been trying to give essentially the same core concepts, translate those insights to many different audiences. I think that's what we're talking about just now. So there's kind of core audience, which I speak less and less to, which are kind of policy scholars, about the theory and how, so that's what I'll talk about tomorrow, about what, you know, how you kind of maintain the theory. But this one would be based on discussions I would have with, initially it was Scottish and UK government civil servants, and they wanted to talk on how you can have more collaboration between civil service and academics. So I also give the same kind of core insights to scientists who are frustrated with their lack of impact with evidence, and researchers, you know, so I'm making a distinction there, I guess, but, you know, scientists not in universities, or, you know, science advisors, or researchers in universities who, at least in the UK, are much more interested in documenting the impact of particular parts of research. So I'm kind of trying to put all that together into a kind of single narrative here. And then it's really a two-parter. I don't know. I won't be offended if you don't come to the second one, but I will refuse to tell you the punchline.
Okay. So you're going to end with a cliffhanger sentence?
Oh, I might do. Well, to be honest, my talk tends to tail off anyway. So this one would be, so actually when I was here, this is the kind of presentation I started with civil service in Wellington, and I think when I was in Melbourne, I kind of, you know, some civil servants there. To be honest, I'm not recording this, but the thing that I'm presenting as interesting, rather than a flaw of mine, is that I don't really know much about New Zealand and Australian politics. I know a lot about UK and Scottish politics, but it doesn't seem to matter with these discussions, because they're relatively abstract, and the same issues would travel quite well across these places. So I suppose I was quite surprised at how little, not effort, but how little I had to adapt the same insights to a different audience. Unless, there's always the chance that I'm just being really polite about it. Probably the context is they're all kind of Westminster family systems, yeah, so maybe that's the definition. So I would go along to, there's a kind of psychology of presentation where you kind of, you don't want to start off kind of offending the audience, unintentionally. I do actually give some talks where essentially my role is to kind of provoke the audience, but this one is more different. So I would start with, the second slide is, what do civil servants need to know to maximise his impact? But I would start with, what do academics need to know? Because then, you know, it's actually their fault. So the first one, this is the most frequent talk I've given, which is, essentially, in a lot of these talks, you know, people in public health or, you know, climate change science are saying, why don't policymakers listen to my evidence? We have evidence on the nature of the policy problem. We have evidence on the relative effectiveness of solutions. So why is there no proportionate policymaking response? So I would say to them, you know, to that kind of audience, it's always five things to do and three reasons for lack of success, just because of the, it's like there's a really interesting the psychology of presentation. So it's always three reasons, isn't it? Because there's something about the number three.
Sure,
yeah.
Right.
And I do five because you can do it on a yeah. So no more. I think any more than five explanations, and you know, it's just not an act. It's not an actual. It's too complicated. So three reasons why policymakers don't pay attention to your evidence. I'd say the first, and they're not real reasons, you know, they're those kind of fancy, clever reasons. So the first is, there are many claims to policy-relevant knowledge. So I think people, some scientists have a really narrow view of what counts as policy-relevant knowledge. And so often I will talk to public health or medical scientists who the reference point would be a hierarchy of knowledge in which the randomized controlled trials and the systematic review are at the top, and expertise is somewhere in the middle, and then down at the bottom is practitioner experience and user feedback or forms of data. I think Brian and I have gone to a million conferences like that where the hierarchy of evidence always comes up as a phrase, either people saying that it's important or people saying, you know, let's get past this. Okay, so say, you know, policymakers have a much more eclectic, possibly sensible view on what counts as good evidence and how you gather it in a short period of time. The second explanation would be that policymakers have to ignore almost all evidence almost all of the time. You know, so I think so I would say that's the same as people, because you there's an almost infinite amount of information out there. You only have a finite amount of time to process it, to make choices, so you have to come up with ways to sift, to ignore almost everything. So sometimes, now this is, if we're being in a kind of reflective mode here, because I'm near the end, but I used to get in slight trouble by making a, you know, provocative distinction between rational ways to ignore information and irrational ways to do it. Now what I used to try and do with scientific audiences is to say to them, you think you're the rational objective scientist, and you think policymakers are irrational, they're making choices almost randomly. But everyone combines cognition and emotion to make choices. You know, so we'd have to understand how policymakers do that, to understand how to be more influential. And then the third one, which I guess would be the contribution for policy studies, which is there is no simple policy cycle in which you know at which stages to present evidence. So if there were, there would be an agenda setting stage where you could provide evidence on the problem. There'll be a formulation stage where you could provide evidence on solutions. There'll be an evaluation stage where you could provide evidence on what happened. So let's say, you know, key responses in that context would be framing evidence rather than letting it speak for itself. Timing, if we've got time, if you want to ask me, this is my question I would like someone to ask is,
we'll play it back.
If you want to just email me the question. People really pick up on a phrase, window of opportunity, and I think I don't like it for a particular reason. Venue shopping, you know, so it's about, you know, finding out, there are many policymakers and influencers spread across the system and try and work out, you know, who you should be trying to speak with. Now then, normally, because I've done a blog post on this, I'll show you the pictures, but people can just read the post, and the pictures will be there. So normally I would show that kind of audience something like this. So I would say, you know, there's the policy cycle, top left. And then I would say, here's what it's, you know, if it's a kind of metaphor, this is much more like it. This is a kind of electricity system in Thailand. You know, it does work. You know, I think that's the key thing. It does work. Now, this is more interesting for me. This is the one reason why governments maintain the image of a science law is it kind of projects what they're doing in a defendable way, particularly in a Westminster system. They say, here's how we're turning our manifesto into policy. You know, we're at the centre and we're using these stages to smooth the process. Now, one of the governments that used to do that most was the European Commission. I mean, possibly partly because it had to come up with ways to demonstrate that it was effective and accountable when not elected. But so the past couple of years I've been going to these conferences and someone from the European Commission has come along with this table and the cycle is in there, but it's covered up with all these red squiggly lines. And so I checked with the author, so I know the author of it, and there are arrows in it that kind of give a soothing sense of causality, but essentially this is just a spaghetti random picture. And the idea is we're just projecting mess. You know, I quite like, we don't have the time to talk about this, but imagine a government going along to a conference and saying, here's our policy process. it's a big mess. You know, it's kind of weird, isn't it? So, now, I like, this is, this is my new picture. There's a previous one with hexagons, but someone told me that you're better off with circles, much more soothing circles, right? So this is, essentially I'm saying, if you want a simple diagram of the pulse process, go with this one. And it's deceptively simple. So actually that's what we'll be talking about tomorrow. I say to the master students, if you can understand all the concepts here, you understand the pulse process. But I don't tell them it'll probably take them a couple of years to do it. You know, okay. But it looks so simple, doesn't it? If you understand what these concepts mean, then off you go. So, that would be, I mean, normally it takes a lot of time to do that, but then I would go on to what do civil servants need to know. Some of them are systemic issues. If you imagine what I've just said to researchers who don't research policymaking, they research something else, they want to engage in the policy process, it might put them off. You know, especially the mess hall, and you think, well, I don't know where to start. And I think that's what it says to most students. You know, they might know, they might be kind of unsure about what to do, and they wouldn't know who to pick up the phone to, no one phones anyone anymore, do they? But who to email. Yeah, so you see, a practical thing is just to kind of have a named person that someone can get in touch with evidence, and they can kind of shortcut your network. And I used to have a couple of people like that in the Scottish Government, where essentially I knew who to speak to within the organisation, and I knew that they would put me in touch with the right person. So I guess the more profound one is that the rewards for engaging with policymakers are not clear. I know in the UK there are increasingly more incentives to engage with policymakers for the impact side of it, but even then, it's actually a really high bar to do it, because you have to publish research and then show an impact for that research. It's not just a general pathways to impact type thing. And I suppose my impression in Australia is people say to me, it will happen in Australia just because it happened in the UK, you know, it's like a usual transfer thing. Or maybe they said, maybe if New Zealand transfers someone to the UK, then Australia will take the New Zealand system. So maybe it's coming, but it's still, right now the rewards for doing it are not clear, and the incentives on it for academics are still to bring in money and to publish in journals, the articles that most people won't read. You know, you, as an academic, you make a piece of that quite quickly. You know, no one's going to read this thing, but it's in a great journal. any sort of day away from publishing articles is a problem, you know, and impact takes you away from that. So what we'd say with this will really vary according to individuals, their knowledge of the policy process, their willingness to engage, and their levels of entrepreneurship. I know it's a terrible word, but a lot of the advice to researchers is be more entrepreneurial, you know, understand what you're doing, and then, you know, make some risks, and, you know, you invest the time or something. But only a small number of people have the sort of opportunity and the motivation to do that, and they tend to be kind of, you know, the white male professors. But, you know, it's not available to everyone. In fact, if you look at Claire Dunlop did this review of all the impact narratives in politics, for example, and 2/3 of the case studies, I think, were of these heroic white male professors coming in, and, you know, everything's really complicated, and but they've cut through the crap, you know, and they've had an impact. I would say there's a kind of parallel with if you do co-production or consultation. You know, as a policymaker, that only a small subset of the population will reply to these things, and if you want more diverse views, you need to improve your techniques to gather information. And it'd be the same with academics. You know, if you don't do that, you'll just have a small subset of the population. So I would then say to them, give academics an incentive to engage with you, and be clear on what you want them to do and what the reward will be for it. Now in the UK, I was saying to them, it's quite a low bar for me. I just need from civil service a letter at the end of it to say that I was excellent, And they stood to work. and somehow changed their way of thinking, because that's the key thing. You know, the impact is in cognitive or behavioural change or something like that. I should say that on the side, I did this, I was an advisor for 6 months on this commission for Scottish Parliament reform, and they put in a sentence, thanks to Paul for challenging our views throughout, and I had kind of helped them write this report. So in a comment thing, I put, can you change it to influence our views? You know, because that would really make a difference, and they didn't. I think that summed up my impact. And then a few things like, you know, flexibility. So we know that civil servants want, they need to provide all the kind of research in a day or a week or a couple of weeks. But you couldn't really expect an academic to drop everything and do that. It's not kind of feasible. Although, to be fair, I tend to do it. if civil servant gets in touch, I'll drop everything I'm doing. So then that kind of leads on to the usual discussion you get in these contexts with the barriers between providers and demanders of evidence. You say, though, I've got a different technical language and jargon, different timescales, different incentives, more or less comfort with uncertainty, more or less a different assessment of how much you should privilege scientific evidence, and a different assessment of how far scientists should go between providing information and advice. And so I've been to a lot of conferences where, if I'm being honest, it's quite weird to watch some scientific professionals trying to grapple with the idea that they might have some beliefs and values that are not to anything to do with the evidence they produce, you know, that they can somehow, you know, put on. I'm actually, I've met people who essentially, they think of themselves as two different people. They, by day, I'm an excellent scientist. By night, I'm an advocate. And you know, somehow they would just, I don't know what they do. You just don't talk to themselves. You know, there's no handover or something like that. So there's a lot of that goes on. So we talk about, you know, a lot of these solutions are quite bland. You know, more contact between policymakers and academics on a regular basis so they can understand each other's language and know what they need and when they need it and what the incentives are and so on. So that's usually, we say, okay, that's all fairly sensible stuff. Let's do more of that. In fact, there's a lot of publications that keep saying that. Lots of more academic practitioner workshops, and you know, this is really going to turn this thing around. So here's more. That was all context. That took a long time, didn't it? But so here's more. So context is everything, after all. So this is an example of something that I've done in this kind of field, which is if you can imagine, look at the production values. That's the thing I want you to take.
That's better than the circles.
Well, the reason is because this is produced by a director of the European Commission, and they've got the production values. Mm-hmm. What a day that was when she said, right, we've done a draft of the thing, but we're going to send it off to the graphics team.
Wow.
That's a different world. Wow. Yeah.
That's breaking the rule.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
which
one? Fog is enough.
But when you're kind of
yeah.
Well, they were in charge. But so this came out of a process. They did their equivalent of a systematic review of how can we bring together the providers of information and demanders of information in a notional organisation. They called it kind of knowledge management for policy organisation. And they did all these kind of World Cafe events, and they looked through some literature, and they did a lot of kind of expert interviews and that sort of thing. And they said that all, you know, they said we reach saturation point, and it comes down to these eight skills of an organisation. So I mean, I don't know. You probably don't want to go through them all in painful detail. Oh, right. Just keep going. Right. I was just going to say, which ones do you want to go? If you're for the tape, we'll go clockwise. Sometimes I've been making the same jokes for 2 weeks. Then I will say this joke about how you know, your sinks go down the opposite way, right? So therefore, do you want to go anti-clockwise?
Yeah, we
want
to go anti-clockwise.
You do want to, right? Okay, no, that's fair enough. I can have that. So where do we start?
Well,
we've started with 2 o'clock. So the first one to note is only one of these 8 skills is about actually producing research. And it is synthesizing research, it's not new stuff. You know, what they want is an answer to the question, what does all the evidence add up to? They don't want the newest thing. Which is actually, I think about it, outside the academic field, quite a sensible approach, you know. Normally, if you've messed with my old comedy routine here, could I finish with this interpersonal skills box, which is some of these map onto our professional development courses, but not this one. This is essentially just you should have good interpersonal skills. Yeah. Okay, so there was more hilarity to be had there, but time. So. Understanding policy and science. So that is essentially, I'm the yellow one. You know, I would put on this course saying, here's the policy process, what you should do with it. Don't try and muscle in on this. Monitoring evaluation, that's a tricky one, because essentially they want to monitor the impact of these organisations. But they had a few workshops on that as well, and most of the evidence they got was from the kind of UK impact process, and most of that suggests that it's really hard to measure academic impact because the world is very complicated and there's no linear relationship. So that's still an open question, that one. This one is more engaging with citizens and stakeholders, so that would be this talk about, you know, don't make it tokenistic. There's some quite evangelical researchers within the kind of European context where they say we're kind of failing in our duty to the public if we don't co-produce research with stakeholders. Analysing policy making, that's an interesting one because I'm getting this right. In a nutshell, there's no time for scientists to draw the line between information and advice. They say if you're just going to give us information and say it's nothing else to do with you, we'll rely on someone else. I mean, I'm perhaps these are my interpretations of their work. Okay. So communicating scientific knowledge, so that is partly about being more concise, but it's also telling a story about why it matters. And then managing expert communities, which is essentially, there's a lot of science advisors who, the skill is in them not projecting the sense that it's their own opinion about the science, but they have a network on which they can draw routinely that can give them a kind of wisdom of crowds type approach, which would be fitting for a kind of hierarchy of evidence type understanding, because expertise is quite low, so they'd have to go beyond their own expertise. So that's an example of one solution to these problems. And that one, I think that one, you get a nice reception for that in other places, that one, because it seems so, I think it's because it seems really doable. They think, it just think, oh, 8 skills, yeah, we could just about do that in an organisation. So,
what was the third one? I didn't quite understand this.
This was about researchers giving more effective advice to policymakers. So it was in that context of that kind of phrase, the honest broker. I don't know if you would know that phrase. He would talk about the distinction between an honest broker who gives good information at the right time and an issue advocate who pushes for a cause. And they're more interested in the issue advocate. Although I should say, there's a real kind of discretionary balance there. They don't want evangelical scientists. They just want people who, if you ask them, what would you do in my shoes, they would give an answer.
That really jumped out at me when you said that too, because my experience with trying to be a policy, have policy impact, is I think what I do sometimes is I present too much like an academic where I'm defending the rigor of what I've done, as opposed to saying, you really need to take notice of this work because I've been out in the field and I've done this really rigorous scientific research and I've come to these conclusions. And everyone says, that's really nice. And nothing happens afterwards. And so I think what it means is the this is what you need to do now.
Maybe. I mean, certainly, there would need
but
to be.
But I worry,
yeah.
And they'll discover who is she otherwise. You know, and
yeah.
Even when you're a woman walking into a room of dick fat, often men, you know,
yeah.
I sort of feel like it's easily dismissible unless I just rig up stuff first. Like,
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, the thing is, I mean, that there are lots of choices to be made between contradictory things, you know. So one would be, you know, you need to do that kind of thing to project your credibility,
mm-hmm.
but you also not need to do it to so that they're not, their attention doesn't wander,
mm-hmm.
something like that,
mm-hmm.
yeah. I mean, I should say, it's quite interesting to think about the way in which I give presentations to these other audiences. The one really, no, in fact, all of that kind of stuff comes up in the introduction to me. Oh, is this, you know, world-renowned experts. No one questions it. You know, it could be. Well, I would question it. You know, if I had more, if it wasn't, you know, if you weren't predicting something, my instinct would be to go to say, no, I'm not really that, not that great.
You should speak to other people. You know.
I find you get a bit more traction when I go Scottish trade unions rather than evidence-based scholar.
Yeah.
I don't feel as if they want.
But also, you could say this is a network, this is not me, this is us.
Yeah.
As a group of researchers, there's meta-analyses, or there's a lot of evidence pointing in that direction, sort of taking the lens off you as the messenger and saying, I'm just one of the representatives here.
Yeah. Also, I mean, I don't know, there are different expectations in different fields, I think.
Mm.
So if you're in epidemiology, for example, you probably couldn't get away without first discussing your methods, or else people would just say, oh, yeah, where did this come from? Made up, you know. Whereas there are some fields where, like, I mean, which I would say mine, you know, I would just project, you know, I'm giving you insights from across the literature, you know, I've read it, you don't have to, sort of thing. I can get away with it more. And I think they don't want to, in my case, they don't want to either. You know, they're not in a position to say, well, if I did this myself, I could have done a better job, which I guess is that problem you've got. Some people are thinking, well, you know, I've got more expertise. And so. But it's very general advice as well. So I think it's more of just trying to project this sense that people do at these conferences essentially say, well, we're scientists producing the best evidence, and there are elected politicians who are here to make these choices. We're not going to cross the line at all between those two things. And I think if I was paraphrasing a lot, I was just saying they find that quite annoying, you know, because essentially those same scientists are saying to them, you know, you must do something about this, but I refuse to tell you what you should do. So there's a kind of balance there. I might skip it. I've just got the sense that I've been talking a lot. So I would then also, one slide away, so I would then show them this thing, which, and you can't, in fact, I'll deliberately make sure you can't see the text. You know. Yeah, it does, I mean, that's really just what I'm pointing at, all the words.
It's not soothing.
But I've learned this. What I would normally say is, don't read the text, I'm going to explain this. Right? But people just do not. They don't, they're sitting there, okay, fair enough, I won't read it. But essentially, well, this one I speak with them very quickly is about. Very quickly, it's I say to them, you know, what is it you're trying to do when you have these relationships with researchers and civil servants? Well, often the answer is, you know, evidence-based policy making or something like that. And so then I would say, well, you know, you're used to it in politics. I go along in a different kind of way and say, this is just a big political slogan, you know, it doesn't mean anything, or, you know, if you interrogate every word, you can completely undermine it. In fact, I've done that in a World Cafe where we spent 2 days trying to define evidence and failed, you know. So, I would say, you know, think of two different models that are both defendable given what you want to do in government. So one is you want to take the best evidence from randomised controlled trials, international RCTs, bring it in and spread best practice across a population. Now, if you want to do that, you would just basically like fidelity. You have to stay faithful to the model because it's been evaluated as a particular package, and you have to roll that out uniformly because you want to monitor its effects. You can't do that if everyone's doing their own thing. So that's one model, and it's completely central government driven, you know, with no local discretion. But also governments want to do the other thing, which is they want to localise, they want to co-produce policy with stakeholders at as low level, a local level as possible, generate different policy responses based on that, and that requires a different engagement with evidence, which is, you know, you tell stories to each other about your experiences of trial and error in particular places, and you, people can take what they want from those lessons and leave what's not relevant. And those, I would say, are two defendable ways to make policy with evidence. So the answer, we want evidence-based policymaking, doesn't really work until you define in some depth what you want to do. And face, this is what I, this, here's my impact that I want from the whole career. It's, I want some policymaker somewhere to face the contradictions between those two models and make a choice between them. You have to say, because most policymakers in that context will say something like, okay, well, let's just try and combine the best bits of what I've described. But they're contradictory, you know, they're based on contradictory philosophies about evidence and how you govern. So I'd just like them to say, okay, well, I've heard that and I've chosen this one or I've chosen this one. I'm not particularly bothered which one they go for. So just make a consistent choice rather than mess.
Why are they reluctant?
Well, I think this is just a feature of government that, or people that we want many different things and many of them contradict each other. So they want to take evidence from international experience from these clinical trials, but they also want to project that they co-produce policy with local stakeholders, particularly in some areas like in one part of New Zealand. Essentially what they wanted to do, and I don't know how they'll do it, I was trying to be positive about this, but on the one hand they want to say to Maori populations, we have all this evidence that the life chances of this population's children are far worse than the rest of the population, and a lot of the evidence of what to do about it are from RCTs from other countries. But also we want to do policy to you, we want to do it in a really respectful manner, so they've got all these models of co-production and stakeholder engagement. Now, I don't know how they're going to put those two things together, because as soon as they do the co-production, it will necessarily go away from the standard models. So they want, both of the aims they have are good, but to put them together is a kind of task. So, yeah. If you imagine, that's a range of things that we talk about. So there's a kind of fundamental problem like that, there's the system in which they engage, and then there's the, you know, speak to each other more often, just so you can kind of work these things through. So that would be the end of the presentation. Actually, in the blog, there's more stuff. But we just kind of move on to discussion. Yeah, you can be assured that the stuff is there.